Hi everyone, it's Aliza Licht here, your host, and I'm so thrilled to share that my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception, is out now. I hope you'll pick up a copy because personal branding is for everyone. It's for the new graduate starting out, the middle manager looking to level up, the executive who wants to be a thought leader, the entrepreneur starting from scratch. It's for anyone who wants to pivot or transition into something new. Because having a strong personal brand means that your name gets dropped in rooms you're not in, and that you're thought of for opportunities that other people haven't even heard of yet. So pick up a copy, and I can't wait to hear what you think. Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. What does the journey from a career in finance to fashion and tech look like? Well, Joanna Hartzmark knows the answer. As the founder and CEO of Revel, Joanna was tired of seeing women carrying the burden of finding ways to feel beautiful in the overwhelming and often unfair world of fashion sizing. We all know how difficult it is to find a pair of jeans, Lord help us all, that actually fit. So she founded Revel to create a solution that was laser focused on adding value to women's lives, not on making them shop more. Revel is an e-commerce brand sitting at the cutting edge of fashion and technology that balances the need for both tech and humanity. Joanna, welcome to Leave Your Mark. I mean, this is such a sore subject for so many people, including myself, and buying jeans is the worst.
You know, it's interesting because originally I was thinking about broader, I mean, all fashion sizing sucks. It's not just jeans, but I really wanted to focus on a single category to really make sure that I perfected that technology. And the truth is, most women wear jeans and most women hate shopping for jeans.
Well, what's interesting about your journey, certainly through all these different industries, is you admit that you didn't have direction growing up. You were sort of open-minded to seeing what the possibilities were. And you credit that to really helping you explore. So tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. I would say that I had a non-linear path. I did not have direction or a clear end goal when I was younger. When people asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I did not have an answer. And even in college, I knew that I wanted to learn. And I knew that in the broadest sense, the quote unquote business world felt compelling to me. But you know, at 18, you don't even know what that means, to be totally honest. And so I really just wanted to explore my interests, see what I was passionate about, and then learn where that would fit in. You know, coming from a more analytical background, I'm not surprised that I fell into finance as my first job. I think that that was something that was very common and very easy to fall into. It seemed like something that a lot of people who were very smart were doing. It seemed like it would challenge me intellectually. But the truth is, that was just the beginning of my meandering journey to where I am now. I didn't love the finance industry, but I loved analytics and decision making. And so I started searching for other industries that might make me feel more connected, just more passionate. And so I tried the next thing. If it didn't fit right, I was always happy to try something else. And I think that's something that we oftentimes are scared to do. We feel like we need that answer early on.
So let's just back up a second. You went to Carnegie Mellon. What did you study?
I went to Carnegie Mellon and I double majored in Chinese studies and decision science. Decision science was a precursor to what would now be called the behavioral economics field, which is an offshoot of traditional economics that accepts that humans are not rational. We don't always make the best decisions. And so how do we think about the analytics of decision-making, accounting for the fact that humans make imperfect decisions all day, every day? And then I minored actually in voice, in vocal studies, just because I love to sing. And purely just because I love it, I added that on there. So from an early age, you can see that I was a little all over the place in my interests.
And what was your goal in studying? You ended up studying Mandarin, right? Did you Correct. Sort of picture a future doing business in China, or what was the foreshadow there?
I did. I actually started studying Mandarin at the end of high school. I moved my junior year of high school from one end of the country to the other. And my new high school had a language requirement, but I was actually already fluent in Spanish from my previous school and previous life. And so the school that I was with had a partnership with the University of Chicago that allowed me to study any language they offered because I had sort of tested out of language in the high school. And I picked Mandarin. I picked it a bit on a lark because I wanted to pick a quote unquote hard language. And I wanted to pick one that I felt would be useful. And again, as a 16-year-old who doesn't quite understand the breadth of the world, you know, people talked a lot about the growth of China. And I felt that that would be a very interesting language to study. And so thinking that it was just going to be one more year fulfilling my language requirement, I signed up for Mandarin and I fell in love with it. What else can I say? I really thought the language was so fascinating, so different from anything I'd ever experienced. And language study is really a window into a culture. And so I decided to continue studying it in college. And I really felt that I'd maybe found my future, that maybe my future did lie living in China and working at a Chinese company. And I did, in fact, move to Shanghai and work for a Chinese company for a period there. And I learned that it really wasn't for me. There were a lot of things about being in business in China that just didn't agree with me or weren't what I was looking for personally. But I would never give up the effort that I put to learn the language, the fact that I do know the language and the lens it gave me into Chinese culture while I was living there. But it was one of the many times in my life where I thought I had found my thing, what that I was going to do forever. And I did a complete 180. Speaking Mandarin is now just a party trick. It's just a fun thing that I saw at the bottom of my resume.
That's so funny. So when you did start in finance, though, backing up to that for a second, what was the moment that you realized, you know what, I don't want to stay here anymore. This is not the industry for me. And was there a moment of like, oh my God, I've done all this work to get here and now I'm just going to say goodbye to it?
It did not take me long to understand that the analytics that I was doing was not, I'll use the word complex enough to keep me engaged for a very long time. When you talk about what I studied, which I said was behavioral economics, so understanding how humans aren't always rational, finance is trying to get people into rational decision-making. We hope that with our financial decisions, we make the soundest, most reasoned decisions. And so all of the analysis and work that I was doing really tried to get people back into that norm. And so I felt that it wasn't accounting for people's biases and their humanity. So it was pretty evident that it would give me an incredible analytical foundation, but wasn't going to be my future because I really needed the messiness of humanity to feel really engaged. That being said, I never felt that I wasted those moments in finance. I felt that my time there was so worthwhile. As I said, I built an incredible analytical foundation that has served me to this day. And I learned a lot about what it was like to work at a giant corporation, this massive bank with tens of thousands of employees. How does that work? I had incredibly intelligent, intellectually curious, humble coworkers who are best friends of mine to this day and who I call to ask for advice. And so I think it's something we need to get away from this notion that by pivoting or moving from one place to another, you've somehow failed or you wasted time. That was some of the most valuable time in my career. It really set me off for the next stage. And so I wouldn't give up those years for anything.
And what made you look toward fashion?
Well, after finance, I went to business school. It seemed the right time for me and also seemed like the type of decision that a lot of people in my network were making. You know, a lot of quote unquote successful, ambitious people felt that business school was a good next step. And I thought it would be a safe space to explore because the truth is I really had no idea what industry I wanted to be in. I knew that I loved the analytics and the decision making of what I was doing. I was developing financial products. I wanted to develop more compelling emotional products. I had no idea where that was possible. And I felt that business school would expose me to industries and positions that I didn't even know existed and would allow me to find my place. So I had no intention of going into luxury retail when I entered business school, but I hadn't ever thought about how luxury retail and where we buy our clothes operate as a business. And I was fascinated specifically with the very high-end luxury. One, the high-end luxury market was just at that point, I would say still realizing how much people shop online. So there was a big digital transformation happening, which for someone who loves data was a really white space area to work in. But then from a pure emotional standpoint, I love fashion. And why does someone want a Gucci shirt versus a shirt from Target? That's not something you can quantify or easily analyze. And I just became fascinated by it conceptually and decided that I wanted to give it a shot.
So a lot of people struggle with what they look like on paper to a recruiter, right? So how did you make yourself on paper make sense to a recruiter in a different industry? Is there any steps you took specifically on your resume or on LinkedIn to sort of tweak your positioning so that someone who was hiring in fashion would actually think about you as a candidate?
Absolutely. I think we need to think of our resumes as storybooks of our lives rather than bullet points of our achievements. And so I think a lot about the language that I use on my resume to find a common thread, because the truth is, I believe there is a common thread in every 180 change in my career. And so it's important to me that everyone understands my passion for consumer behavior, my passion for understanding how people make imperfect decisions, and that we need to embrace that about them. Now, I am an analyst at its core, and so I use that term in a lot of my different positions because it does show a common thread as far as a skill set is concerned. But I think that we oftentimes get so obsessed with showing numbers on our resume that we don't think about telling the story of our lives and our passions and what we really want to be doing.
So did you do that sort of at the blurb at the top, have like an opening synopsis of the story of your life?
I will say, and this may not make people happy, I have multiple resumes.
No, that's essential. It's absolutely essential.
It is. It's really important. And so depending on the position and how much explaining I felt that I needed to do, I had different versions. And that also expands to cover letters. No one wants to have to write a cover letter, but a cover letter is a huge aid in telling your story. And so I've always had multiple versions depending on if I was applying to a much more analytical position, even within fashion. I felt that that was much more easily explained versus if I needed a full cover letter to tell my story. And so I very much send that out dependent on the position and company.
So smart. So you obviously get this experience. You do land at a company in fashion and you sort of get your feet wet in understanding sort of the operations and the way things run in that company. And then at what point did you sort of start to think about this underlying problem that you're now trying to solve?
I wasn't thinking about this specific problem per se when I was in luxury retail. I think what was the big realization for me in the luxury space was, quite frankly, how difficult it is to turn a massive ship. So these luxury retail houses have huge traditions, many, many years built up their reputations in order to have this aspirational brand. And while I had gone to this company in order to help them transform their digital presence and build a new e-commerce site, the truth was that they were somewhat hampered by their years of tradition of being a much more high-touch in-person brick and mortar company and were really unable to let go of that to innovate. And so my big realization was the difficulty of innovating and being agile at a very large company and how that can hurt the fashion space, which I felt had so much opportunity for innovation as we moved to the digital sphere. And so my realization that is still a huge part of what I do now at that point was more about what we should be doing with e-commerce specifically and the digital experience of shopping versus more traditional brick and mortar shopping. It wasn't until my next jump more into the tech space that I started to think about the specific problem of clothing sizing and more broadly, the burdens that we as women just are expected to shoulder and soldier on.
When you talk about luxury retail or even any big company, one of the things that I think is a huge factor in sort of the industry being behind is this idea that you have to spend years putting a plan together, researching, doing your due diligence. Doing your due diligence versus being nimble enough to innovate when you see that something's starting to take hold. Did you also see that on your end? And do you think, I mean, listen, I worked for LVMH for years. And if we were under sort of their rule book as far as like how long it takes before you decide to do something, I would have never been in digital at all.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. I think it's very interesting to think about how large corporations, as you say, not just fashion, handcuffs themselves.
Yeah,
is true. The only way I can think about it. They are holding themselves back from making really life-changing decisions for consumers. Now, I do think now that I've taken the full leap into startup land, there is a balance between respecting and understanding what came before you because there are existing structures and saying, you know what, I'm going to do it anyway. I found a better way. And so I wish that there was more balance between the two. But the truth is, these large corporations have developed so much bureaucracy and processes that they make it impossible for the people who have great ideas that are probably backed by a lot of evidence to actually execute them. And so I found that to be incredibly frustrating, because I would spend time building a deck to make a point that wouldn't even be listened to. And maybe, you know, months later, maybe someone would ask the same question and I could try again. But in general, people were very set in their ways.
I mean, every single person who hears you say that when this comes out is going to take it like a deep breath, like I just did, because it's such a dog and pony show.
Yes.
And especially if you're someone, I am someone who loves innovation. So for me, it's like nails on a chalkboard when people are like, we want to innovate. We want to be, you know, we want to be cutting edge. And it's like, but actually you don't, because you don't actually want to make any changes.
People are so terrified of both change and of making a decision. And so they hide behind this smokescreen of create a deck, show me the strategy, instead of just doing it. And it's something I am constantly, constantly reminding my team. If you're creating a deck for the sake of creating a deck, stop now. Only show me slides if you need to convey something to me. We can talk through things. You can show me your Excel. There's no reason to ever be creating some sort of visual to prove a point just for the sake of saying that we have a deck per se. And so we're pretty anti-deck at Revel, I will say. You got to have slides sometimes, but in general, I am always hammering into them, is what you're doing necessary for us to make the next decision and move forward? Or is it just something that has become busy work? Because as soon as it becomes busy work, it's out.
I mean, I wish more people were like you. So when you did pivot from fashion into tech in that sort of intersection, this specific idea for Revel, did it come to you and you wrote it on like a napkin at dinner somewhere? Or like, what was the moment that you were like, wait, I think I can like actually dig into this problem?
I wish I had a wonderful cocktail napkin story, but it really was a gradual build and then a sudden tumble into entrepreneurship, because I really never planned on starting my own company. It was not something I ever imagined myself doing. And even though I had friends who pitched me on being their co-founders and starting companies, I always said, nope, I don't think entrepreneurship is for me. I was surprised by myself that I ended up at this tech company after Ralph Lauren, but I really felt that they were at an interesting place at that intersection of tech and fashion. And I felt I could learn a lot going to a smaller company. This was a more established startup at that point. And I was, one, immediately sucked in with the amount of change that we were allowed to enact on a daily basis. And so it was an immediate seduction into the startup space. I will admit that. I loved the fact that we could make decisions quickly, see what the results were, just test and learn our way to innovation. And I became obsessed with that. But the truth is, what was really the seed that brought me towards Revel was less so about the specific problem of clothing sizing and more as I entered the tech space, looking around at the startups that were growing quickly and feeling that there weren't enough who were, one, solving problems specifically for women, and two, of those who were solving problems specifically for women, allowing women to be the ones to lead that solution. And so I really started getting a bit of a bee in my bonnet, if you will, about how many companies were built for women by women in the tech space. And, you know, I think there are lots of jokes made about the tech bros in Silicon Valley. I think that there are so many industries that are dominated by men, but I felt that this was a place that I really could make change for women because there was so much agility in the startup space specifically. And so I started thinking about what it would be like to build a startup exclusively about solving a problem that women face every day and having women be the ones who lead building that solution. And that is what led me to Revel more than anything.
Such a great story. And you know what? Maybe you don't have a cocktail napkin story, but you certainly have a story. I'm curious though, because the reluctant entrepreneur is, I mean, I'm that, I identify as that.
That's my new favorite term. I've never heard that.
Oh yeah. Cause it's like, you are one, but you just can't believe you are. And you're also like dragging your feet, which is me more than you, obviously at this point. But at what point do you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to like really invest the time and the money and the energy and the blood, sweat, and tears into figuring this out? And how did you have the courage to do that? Because I do think it is actually much easier to get a job. Regular job.
Yes. I would say abject terror is the best way to describe how I felt at the very beginning, especially as someone who felt one of the many, many reasons I never wanted to become an entrepreneur is because the beginning seemed so scary to me. When it's just you, just an idea, and there's nothing else tangible to hang on to. And I was terrified of that moment. But as I said, I started to get just frustrated looking around at the tech space and feeling that there weren't enough companies trying to solve these problems, these burdens. I always talk about, there are so many just extra burdens that women are expected to just take on, live our lives, and not say anything about. And I said, there has to be someone who understands how important it could be to relieve just one of these burdens. And so as I got that stuck in my head, I, unbeknownst to myself, started thinking about what problem did I feel that I was uniquely positioned to solve, that I could really make a difference in women's lives. And once I started thinking about that and started just mentally outlining, I was too scared to write on a cocktail napkin. I didn't want to admit this was the path that I was going down.
I get it. I get it.
Yeah, there's a little bit of denial in the reluctant entrepreneur, or a lot of denial. But once I had thought through it enough to really believe that I might be able to create it, there was just no turning back for me mentally. And so I was terrified, completely terrified, but I really thought I could do it. And that's the only thing that kept me going at the beginning, is I think I might actually be able to create something that will make a difference in women's lives, that will actually add value to their day to day. And that was what got me going every single day at the beginning, when I was quite frankly miserable a lot of the time, sitting alone on the couch with my laptop, trying to create a company from thin air.
My friend Dori Clark, who wrote The Long Game, has this great analogy where she says to look for the raindrops when you're starting something, because you always feel the first raindrop, right? You always know, okay, it's going to rain. Let me get an umbrella. I just love this analogy. And basically the idea of when you're trying to build something or you're trying to do something, it's really easy to feel like you're failing all the time. But if you look for the raindrops, like the tiny signs of progress, you'll know you're on the right path. So for you, what were some of those raindrops that kept you sort of climbing that process?
You know, it's funny, at the beginning, when I was really struggling to move forward, I actually sort of created my own little rule, which is that I should be failing at least once a day. If I'm not failing at least once every day, then I'm not trying enough things. Because when you're starting with white space, you need to be constantly experimenting. And so I believe success is a product of millions of failures. And so in that sense, that was really important to me, to feel progress at the beginning. As far as tangible moments, the raindrops, it's funny when you think about the first raindrop and how you sort of flinch back at it. That's how you feel, I think, constantly in entrepreneurship. I adore this analogy of like, oh, I didn't realize. That's a huge moment. And I think for me, it was actually when I went from believing that I could build a technology that would help women find clothes that fit them better, to understanding that I needed to build something far beyond a technology, something that, again, accounted for the emotions and the humanity of how women feel about their bodies. That was my biggest raindrop and biggest pivot at the beginning, for me thinking, oh, I'm just going to build, a simple algorithm, perhaps, to saying, no, this needs to be a company. It needs to be a huge consumer-facing transformative experience in how we all shop online.
So how do you feel like you're helping the emotional and the humanity side of it?
Well, when I started, I really felt that part of the problem was that we get so obsessed with the size chart when we think about shopping online. The size chart, however, is a linear line of numbers that most brands arbitrarily assign to their clothing. Women's bodies are not constructed in a linear line. First and foremost, there is infinite complexity and beauty in women's bodies. But two, there's no transparency in how brands actually conform their own clothes into that linear line. So I felt really strongly that we need to talk about shape before size, and that it was much more important to find brands and products that suited each unique body shape. And then the linear size chart is just a way to navigate which of those products is going to fit your body. But first, you need to map yourself or find out what brands and products fit your body shape. So in that sense, I had a key insight into how we could navigate shopping within the size chart. However, as I was building that more technical solution, what really hit home for me was the fact that fit is subjective. Fit means something different to every woman. When she gets dressed, she needs to feel beautiful. And that might be a slightly tighter fit for some people, looser fit for others. There is so much emotion into how we want to present ourselves to the world. And that was the biggest realization as I was building Revel. There is no way to build a purely technical solution to this problem, because even if my algorithm has mapped your body shape and figured out the perfect product in the right size based on this technology for you to wear, if you put it on and you hate it, we have failed. And so rather than telling people what was supposed to fit, let's ask them what fit means to them. And so that's the key of Revel, is that women have to be a part of this equation. Women know their bodies and they know how they want them to feel. And we can't ignore the fact that there are a lot of external voices telling us how we're supposed to feel about our bodies. So let's acknowledge that reality and help women truly feel beautiful when they get dressed in the morning, not tell them how they're supposed to feel in their clothes.
Yeah, I could not agree more. So you've been in existence for 2 years now.
Just about, right? Yes.
Just about 2 years. So what does success look like for Revel now?
At this stage, I feel as though I've already seen success beyond what I would have expected. We launched during the pandemic, which was a really interesting time to launch this digital experience. And I've been really overwhelmed by the amount of support that we've gotten from our early adopters. Because the truth is, this business is about trust, trusting that we are actually trying to help and trying to find a solution. And so we've built a really incredibly solid foundation, a wonderful community of women who like what we're building and want to see more of it. And so we're at a wonderful inflection point of the company of saying, okay, it's time to see what more we can actually do. People want a solution to this problem. People are excited about the solution that we're building. To me, that is the biggest success I could ever imagine at this point. And so the amount of faith people have put in us as we build and get this to the next level, that to me feels like if everything were to somehow be destroyed tomorrow, I would still consider this a success.
Walk us through the user experience for sort of signing on.
So Revel is its own personalized shopping experience. So you go to our site and you create a free membership. It does not cost money because women are not the ones who should be bearing the burden of this problem that was not created by us. but you do need to answer some questions about your body so that our technology can function. So the first time you visit, you'll answer those questions and create a free account. Any other time, you simply log in. Once you've logged in, you are entered into a personal store. So it looks similar to any other store you might experience, Nordstrom.com. The difference being, it is populated only with products that we believe will fit your body and are available in the size that that particular product should be bought by you. So we know your body shape, we know your fit preferences. As you interact more with the store, we learn even more about your style and fit preferences. And we only show you products that we believe will fit you based on all that knowledge. We believe the size number should be an afterthought. It's the least important part of this equation. And so we know how all of these brands and products run in their size arrays. And so once you've found a product that you love, when you click on it, we'll tell you what size we think you should buy and why. So then you can decide if you want to purchase that size or another. But the idea is that you don't have to think about the number on the label.
And right now it's only jeans. What would be the next sort of category that you would go into eventually?
Our community is up in arms about that because everyone has their own unique category that they really hate shopping for. I do think we'll continue with clothing. So dresses are likely next. I know that swimwear and intimates are huge pain points.
Swimwear.
Yes.
Such a good one.
And so know that those are absolutely on the docket as well. My goal is eventually to have all products on there. I want to create a universal way for women to navigate the world of fashion and feel that they have more opportunities to feel beautiful, not fewer opportunities.
On the days that things don't go as well, like you sound super positive, rainbows and roses today, which I love. But on the days where things are not going well, there's tech issues, things didn't line up in the way that you thought, how do you coach yourself back?
I mean, most days, something's not going well. And so part of being an entrepreneur is saying that's just how this works. And so there are going to be good things and bad things every day. Today, in fact, I had a very frustrating morning. We're redesigning the site because we want to improve the performance. We've been listening to feedback. We'd like to make it faster. And we are hitting into huge technical snags as we get it done. But the truth is, every issue you encounter is something more you learn about the site and also learn about how you react. And so I choose to take every failure, every mistake, every issue as a way to learn and grow and figure out how to do it better the next time. That doesn't mean that I don't get incredibly disheartened and sometimes just need to go for a little walk around the block. When things are really bad, I try to detach myself from my computer. But the truth is, it's just in my mind about reframing everything as a way to learn more about what you're doing.
You have an exemplary leadership style by not downloading stress to your team.
I try.
How do you do that? And what are some tips you could give other managers who don't seem to be able to take on the stress without passing it along?
Well, I will say being a founder is incredibly stressful, but being a team leader is a different skill set altogether. And I think that people confound the two. And so they think being a visionary founder and building something incredibly innovative automatically makes you a wonderful CEO or manager. But the truth is, managing people is a completely different set of leadership skills. And specifically, while you might be incredibly good at building something, to manage people, your job is to protect them so that they can build, so that they can work. And so I frequently am telling my employees, remember that I'm your shield. So if you need to use me as a shield to protect you from incoming requests, to protect you from not understanding something, do you need to use me as an excuse in order to get something that you need? I can be your smokescreen for a request that you might feel uncomfortable making. That is the most important thing to me as a leader, is to remember that my job is to clear obstacles and protect my employees so that they can operate at their best. But there are so many tactical things that managers can do that I think they often don't, in order to not just shield their employees from stress, but not give them additional stress. If we just took an extra second to think about, what does it feel like when your boss messages you on Friday afternoon? You know, a lot of people just have ideas on Friday afternoons. Maybe they get on Slack and send a message and don't think about what does it feel like as an employee to receive that message. And so I try always to take the extra second and say, why am I saying this now? What is it going to mean to them? And so sometimes there are things that I need to make sure I don't forget. And so I will send a message on Friday afternoon. Just a little bracket in the front that says not urgent, I think is very helpful. Very small things when you are setting up a touch base on their calendar, make sure they know we're just talking about X. Give them a specific agenda so they don't think they're about to be fired.
Yeah, so true. So true.
And so I really think that empathy and putting yourself in the shoes, we all at one point work for someone else. And we remember what it was like to get, for me, the dreaded hi message with no other context from your boss. Do not stop doing that to people. And so I just try to take that extra second all the time to put myself in their shoes and not create unnecessary panic. And I try very hard to keep my stress my own.
Great advice. What makes you excited to start each day?
Right now, I will say it is my team. I found the beginning so difficult being alone, but to have a team of people who are as excited as I am about building what we do, people that I get to collaborate with, who help me learn and grow even faster than I could alone, is the absolute best thing I could have hoped for. And so knowing that they're there waiting for me, making sure that I can get us to the next level, is the best motivator that I could possibly have, alongside the obviously constant motivator of we're creating something really cool for women. And I think that will always be the thing that gets me to put one foot in front of the other every day, even when things are really, really hard. And, you know, at the very beginning, I talked to a friend who was a serial entrepreneur about whether or not I should do this in the first place. And his advice was don't do it if you feel that you need to ask me about it. Because if you're not sure enough to know, you shouldn't be doing it.
Oh, harsh.
I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's amazing advice, but I love how blunt he was. A lot of women struggle with the whole idea of fundraising or going alone in the beginning or eventually taking money. What is your perspective on that?
So currently, Revel is entirely bootstrapped. So I have self-funded to this point. That was a decision that I was privileged to be able to make in the first place, which I think is important to acknowledge, but one that I made very thoughtfully as I tried to decide what kind of entrepreneur I wanted to be. As a reluctant entrepreneur, I spent a great deal of time at the very beginning thinking about philosophically what it meant to start your own company. What type of leader did I want to be? What type of founder did I want to be? And I really wanted to do as much of that discovery on my own and to feel as though I had control of my own destiny, really. And so while I knew the problem that I wanted to solve, I didn't know how the solution would manifest. And I didn't think that I wanted other people telling me what I should be doing. So as someone who was lucky enough to self-fund, I said, I'm going to see what I can build. I'm going to see if I can validate that there isn't the correct solution for this out there right now and see if I can get women on board and build something real. And then I'll revisit fundraising at that time. I'm also a huge believer that the decision you make today might not be the decision you should make tomorrow. And every single day you should reevaluate what you decided yesterday. And it's fine if yesterday's decision is wrong today. It doesn't mean you failed. It means you learned something new. And so at the beginning, I was very against fundraising. I wanted to bootstrap this as long as possible. And the truth is the growth has been really significant and has helped me realize all of these additional avenues that we could be exploring if we did have an infusion of capital. So I'm just now starting to think about what that will look like for Revel. And that's something I didn't really think that I would be exploring at this point this early. But things change and you have to be able to evolve your vision for what you're building for the greater good of the company and the greater good of the women that I hope that we'll be helping along the way.
Thank you for sharing that so transparently. I think you're 100% right. And I think that you're weighing every decision as you should be. And you'll make the right decision. And it might be different than the one you previously made. And I think that's great. So ultimately, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, or however long this takes to like really come to fruition, how do you want to leave your mark?
I mean, I hope that I have made a lasting impact on women's lives. I hope that I have alleviated some of these burdens that we feel every day. And, you know, sometimes when I look around at the world, I feel that what I'm doing is trivial. You know, I'm just dealing with fashion, with shopping, with clothing sizing. But the truth is, this is about how women feel in their own skin, how we belong, how we present ourselves to the world. And so if I can make a difference in this world, I will feel so successful. But beyond that, we're talking 10, 15 years, I hope I can become someone that young women look up to or come to when they are struggling with how to feel successful on their own terms, when they're struggling with not feeling like they know exactly what they want to do and feeling like that's somehow wrong. I really hope that I can be continuing to make an impact on women's lives, not just in a broad sense with a company like Revel, but in an individual sense with every young woman who grows up not being sure if she can really make it.
Oh, so well said, Joanna. This was awesome. Thank you so much for coming on Leave Your Mark. And I'm excited to see where this goes.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so wonderful.
Thanks so much for listening to Leave Your Mark, the podcast. If you want more career advice, be sure to pick up a copy of my best-selling book, Leave Your Mark. If you're on Instagram, make sure to follow at Leave Your Mark Podcast to stay up with the latest episodes. And of course, say hi to me at Aliza Licht XO. If you're on Twitter, definitely reach out at Aliza Licht. I would love to hear from you. If you want to subscribe to my newsletter or attend a future virtual mentoring event, go to alizalicht.com for more information. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.